Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Classic FM. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, country, rock and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Our musical trivia questions come to us from the websites onthisday.com and americansongwriter.com. Question number one, it was on this very day back in 1750 that composer Johann Sebastian Bach died. What was the cause of his death? Was it A, typhoid fever? Was it B, an unsuccessful eye operation? Was it C, the plague? Was it D, a stroke? Or was it E, untreated diabetes? To what, then, is Johann Sebastian Bach's death attributed? And question number two, it was on this day back in 1963 that the folk group Peter, Paul and Mary released a recording of a protest song written the previous year by Bob Dylan, which addressed a series of rhetorical questions about peace, war, and freedom. What was the name of that song? Was it A, This Land Is Your Land? Was it B, Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Was it C, Blowin' in the Wind? Was it D, We Shall Overcome? Or was it E, Stand By Your Man? So what was that Peter, Paul and Mary folk song from 1963 written by Bob Dylan? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July 28th. Well, it was 90 years ago today, 1933, that the very first singing telegram was sent. It was given to Rudy Valley on his 32nd birthday. Singing telegram, 1933, today. And it was on this very day, back in 1939, that Judy Garland recorded the song Over the Rainbow. That song was featured in the film The Wizard of Oz, recorded on this day by Judy Garland in 1939.
I know why I've waited. I know why I've been blue. I've prayed each night for someone exactly like you.
Tony Bennett and Katie Lang, Exactly Like You, introduces our jazz transitions news. It's titled, Tony Bennett, Champion of the Great American Songbook, is Dead at 96. From his initial success as a jazzy crooner, through his generation-spanning duets, his career was remarkable for both its longevity and its consistency. This is published in the NewYorkTimes.com on the 21st of July, 2023, by Bruce Weber. Tony Bennett followed in the musical path of the greatest American pop singers of the 20th century and carried the torch for them into the 21st. Tony Bennett, a singer whose melodic clarity, jazz-influenced phrasing, audience-embracing persona, and warm, deceptively simple interpretations of musical standards helped spread the American songbook around the world and won him generations of fans. He died on Friday in New York City. He was 96. In February 2021, his wife, Susan Bennett, told AARP, the magazine, that Mr. Bennett learned he had Alzheimer's disease in 2016. He continued to perform and record despite his illness. His last public performance was in August 2021 when he appeared with Lady Gaga at Radio City Music Hall in a show titled One Last Time.
Exactly like you. Now why should we spend money on a show for two? No one does those love scenes exactly like you.
And in music research and technology, we have this article titled, A Simple Trick to Prevent Songs from Getting Stuck in Your Head. This is published in mentalfloss.com by Jessica Hollinger and the 28th of April, 2015. We've all been victims of the earworm. A catchy piece of music gets stuck in our heads, and no matter what we do, we can't seem to dislodge it. In case you're wondering, some of the most common earworms, according to researchers, are Single Ladies by Beyoncé, Bad Romance by Lady Gaga, Let It Go from the movie Frozen, and I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. Earworms are incredibly common. 90% of us suffer from earworms at least once a week. And while they're not actually harmful, they can be really distracting. In one survey, a third of participants classified their earworms as unpleasant, which is a nice way of saying severely annoying. Some people claim they can't control this phenomenon, but most of us just have to suffer through it. But fear not. Researchers have come to the rescue with a scientifically backed earworm prevention weapon, bubblegum. Yes, scientists at the University of Reading, UK, say the best way to treat earworms is to chew gum. Why we get earworms in the first place isn't exactly clear, but one likely culprit is the brain's auditory cortex, which processes sound. Dr. Philip Beeman, an associate professor of cognitive science at the University of Reading, says the brain's tendency to repeat a familiar tune may be a form of involuntary musical memory. One proven method for degrading short-term memory is to repeat a random word over and over again in your head. The official term for this is irrelevant subvocalization. Previous studies have shown that mouthing something random like the first few letters of the alphabet while looking at a list of words makes most people forget one-third to one-half of the words on the list, explains Deborah Netbum at the Los Angeles Times. The act of chewing gum has a similar effect, the new research suggests, and therefore can be recommended as an aid to get rid of earworms. If you're not a fan of gum, you could also pick up a puzzle book when you can't shake an annoying song. Previous research suggests solving a tough anagram or Sudoku can help. The key is to find something that will give you the right level of challenge. Dr. Ira Hyman, a music psychologist at Western Washington University, told The Telegraph, if you are cognitively engaged, it limits the ability of intrusive songs to enter your head. You don't want something too difficult, or your mind will wander, and you don't want something too easy. It's like a Goldilocks effect. It can't be too easy, and it can't be too hard. It's got to be just right, Hyman says. Others fight off earworms with another song. Psychologist Vicki Williamson told NPR, some people think that the British national anthem sung quite slow is good for getting rid of earworms, she says.
Everybody's feeling gay when they hear this fella say.
There's a really big show tonight. A really big show tonight.
We got 16 tons of atomic ore. We got next year's Army Navy score. And the first four battles of the Civil War.
It's a really big show tonight.
Ed Sullivan's Really Big Shoe opens our pop music news. It's titled The Ed Sullivan Show Turns 75, Looking Back on the Show's Legacy. Below, before The Sopranos and Succession ruled Sunday night, there was The Ed Sullivan Show, serving up a cultural smorgasbord for the whole family. This is written by Billy Altman, published on June the 9th, 2023, in Parade magazines. Ed Sullivan was 46 years old and a relative unknown when on June 20th, 1948, the CBS television network introduced him as the host and co-producer of a new Sunday night variety program called The Toast of the Town. Leaning heavily on the show business connections he'd cultivated over the years as a newspaper columnist, Sullivan's lineup that evening included the comedy team of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, Broadway giants Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, a ballet dancer, a classical pianist, an interview with a boxing referee, and a Bronx fireman who'd won a community singing contest.
Show.
And we're all gonna go.
Goo, not go.
Well, shoe or show or goo or go. We really, really, really got a big one tonight.
On paper, the mix made little sense. Yet, from that night on, as Ed Sullivan continued to present his hand-picked but seemingly random assortment of performers, and notably continued to fumble his way through between-act segues and commercial announcements, the program began to attract a steady following. Sullivan's Toast of the Town was, by the end of 1948, one of the early TV's highest-rated programs. At the height of his popularity in the late 1950s and 1960s, Ed Sullivan's program averaged an estimated viewership of well over 40 million. It was a testament to his unfailing lack for assessing on a weekly basis the entire width and breadth of the entertainment galaxy. Highbrow, lowbrow, and everything in between. He then chaperoned its best and or brightest to a general audience whose overall taste he understood and ultimately helped shape. In so doing, Sullivan served as perhaps the most important cultural gatekeeper for multiple generations of Americans. He brought viewers showcase performances by acts ranging from the Bolshoi Ballet to Johnny Puello and his harmonica gang, Sam Levinson to Senor Wences, Richard Burton to Richard Pryor, Mahalia Jackson to the Jackson Five, and, of course, from Elvis Presley to the Beatles. To paraphrase Frank Sinatra's New York, New York, for just about any entertainer on the planet, if you could make it there on the Ed Sullivan Show, you could make it anywhere. By any imaginable standard, Sullivan was easily the most unlikely star in the history of television. He was a master of ceremonies whose presence on his own show was so devoid of showbiz pizzazz and personal charisma that he was often referred to as simply Old Stone Face, And yet, for 1 hour every Sunday night for nearly a quarter of a century, Sullivan was welcomed into living rooms across America with a loyalty that remains unequaled since his show went off the air in 1971. How did he do it? Sullivan once said he followed a simple formula: open big, have a good comedy act, put in something for the children, and keep it clean. That formula was informed by Sullivan's innate sense of good-willed age, race, and ethnicity blind inclusion, a product of his upbringing. Excelling at sports, he played with and against a diverse group of area athletes, which instilled in him important social values. On the field, your name or color or religion cut no ice, he had later recalled. You stood or fell on your own performance. Bitten by the journalism bug while still in high school, Sullivan began writing about sports for his local paper. Not long after graduating, he moved to Manhattan, where he spent the roaring 20s working his way up the newspaper ladder as a sports writer for various tabloids. In 1942, he produced and brought to Broadway an all-African-American review, Harlem Cavalcade, and after the U.S. entered World War II, he tirelessly organized and emceed benefit shows sponsored by everyone from the Red Cross to the United Jewish Appeal, raising hundreds of thousands of dollars for the war effort. Television was still a new mass medium in 1948. Intrigued by the job Sullivan had recently done hosting the broadcast of a daily news-sponsored dance competition, CBS put him on the air with his own show. Recognizing that Broadway theaters were traditionally dark on Sunday nights, he began engaging members of hit productions to perform scenes from their shows. He sometimes staged hour-long tributes to icons such as Cole Porter and Helen Hayes. Then, on September 9, 1956, came the icing on the cake, spelled E-L-V-I-S. It was Presley's first performance on The Sullivan Show that drew the biggest audience, as an estimated 60 million viewers, a staggering one-third of the entire country, tuned in. While Presley was already being hailed as the king of rock and roll, his initial appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show was, for America, the official coronation. As a result of Elvis's breakthrough, Sullivan tapped into the teen audience throughout the remainder of the 1950s. He booked performances by virtually all the biggest rock and roll and pop acts, including Buddy Holly, Fats Domino, the Everly Brothers, the Platters, Bo Diddley, Connie Francis, Johnny Mathis, and Sam Cooke. Ever the civil rights advocate, Sullivan continued to showcase African-American performers such as Ray Charles, Nina Simone, Dionne Warwick, and James Brown, and Motown artists like Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the Temptations, the Supremes, and the Four Tops. Their collective appearances underscored Sullivan's leveling the playing field for all philosophy. February the 9th, 1964, is probably the most famous date in the history of the Ed Sullivan Show, as 73 million Americans tuned in to see the Beatles make their live debut on U.S. soil. In contrast to Presley's first appearance, here Sullivan led the way, making the decision to book the band after he'd been tipped off by his European talent scout about their phenomenal success abroad. Just as it had been with the 50s rock and roll following Presley's debut, the Beatles' conquering of America opened the door for the British invasion, and Sullivan soon was welcoming acts such as The Animals, The Searchers, Petula Clark, Dusty Springfield, Lulu, The Dave Clark Five, and Herman's Hermits. The Rolling Stones made several notable appearances as well, though not without some rough patches. Eventually, between the growing generation gap of the 1960s and the emergence of the youth counterculture late in that decade, close-knit family life in much of America began to show signs of unraveling, and Ed Sullivan and his show began to show their age as well. As the decade turned, CBS began looking to appeal to a younger, more urban demographic, and in early 1971, Sullivan was notified that his program was going to be canceled. The final presentation of a new weekly, The Ed Sullivan Show, took place on March 28, 1971, and October 13, 1974, fittingly on a Sunday night, the great showman passed away at age 73. His is a legacy that lives on, unsurpassed in not only television history, but in the entire history of popular culture as well. So how'd you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this very day back in 1750 that composer Johann Sebastian Bach died. What was the cause of his death? Was it A, typhoid fever, B, an unsuccessful eye operation, C, the plague, D, a stroke, or E, untreated diabetes? Correct answer? Well, it's complicated. As noted in ClassicFM.com, everyone knows that Beethoven suffered with his hearing, but not so many people are aware that Bach struggled terribly with his eyesight. In fact, botched surgery on his eyes by the English ocular specialist John Taylor reportedly caused Bach's death in 1750. An article in Oxford Bach Soloist from 11 June 2018, however, adds these possible alternative explanations. The received wisdom for many years concerning Bach's death was related to his eye operations. Bach's eyesight was always a problem for the composer, weakened in his youth by too much studying, often throughout the night. As he matured into old age, his sight became so bad that he sought medical help. After two botched cataract operations conducted by the English oculist Sir John Taylor, Bach lost his sight almost completely. He was bedridden from April to July 1750 before suffering a stroke. 10 days later, he was dead. He was just 65 years old and still in possession of his quick mental acuity. There has been some suggestion that cataracts give little pain of the type Bach described in his letters and are not generally life-threatening. The botched operations weakened Bach's system, but given the length of time between his last surgery and his death, it's unlikely that infection was the cause. Could it be that the problems with his eyes had been brought on by untreated diabetes? Biographer Christoph Wolff suggests that while Bach did have trouble with his eyesight, the rapid deterioration in his later years was due to an underlying and undiagnosed illness. The most convincing hypothesis suggests an old age-related diabetic condition as the origin of Bach's final illness. It is likely that the botched cataract operations damaged Bach's eyes, but that his body was probably weakened by untreated diabetes. Correct answer, evidently, could be either answer B, botched eye surgery, D, a stroke, or E, untreated diabetes. And the answer to our second question? It was on this day back in 1963 that the folk group Peter, Paul, and Mary released a recording of a protest song written the previous year by Bob Dylan, which addressed a series of rhetorical questions about peace, war, and freedom. What was the name of that song? Was it A, This Land Is Your Land, B, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, C, Blowing in the Wind, D, We Shall Overcome, or E, Stand By Your Man? Correct answer? Answer C, Blowing in the Wind. As noted in an article published in AmericanSongwriter.com, this song, written by Dylan, was a hit single by Peter, Paul, and Mary, who performed it at the 1963 March on Washington, in which Martin Luther King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. Dylan said he wrote the original draft of the song, which had only the first and third verse, very quickly, in about 10 minutes. The music was derived from the Negro spiritual No More Auction Block. The lyric evoked biblical verse that posed a series of elemental questions about mankind, always with the same implied answer, that in time, man must transcend the senseless inhumanity of war. It's a structure which some have considered vague or intentionally ambiguous, but neither are really accurate, as the songwriter's meaning comes across with clarity. Dylan's intention is not ambiguous at all. In each verse, he drives home the message which echoes Jefferson's famous word in the Constitution, "Some truths are self-evident." These answers, Dylan writes, are self-evident, and as obvious and indisputable as the wind. These lines do not leave the listener to decide on an issue. They don't ask what is wrong or right, but how long will it take for people to wake up to the truth? Peter, Paul, and Mary became one of the most beloved and commercially successful folk groups ever. Their version of this song was not only popular, it was a major radio hit, climbing up to number 2 on the pop charts. Yet the shining beauty of its message was not missed, as it became one of the most iconic anthems of the time. Peter, Paul, and Mary performed it, as did Dylan, at many historic events. Of these, none was more monumental than Martin Luther King's 1963 March on Washington, in which he delivered his "I Have a Dream" speech. The trio sang "Blowin' in the Wind" in perfect harmony in front of the Lincoln Monument, a real-time wind blowing with the lyrical one. At the moment, and ever since, there was no doubt about this song being too ambiguous and unclear. Its message rang out then, as it has ever since. It is a song for the ages. So let's close out today's program with that earworm from Frozen, "Let It Go."
Now they know, let it go.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words: kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long. Until next time.